All right. These are some of the instructions for the exam. It's going to happen in class on Thursday. And again, if you're restricted from coming to class that day because you have COVID or related symptoms or you're being quarantined, I still expect you to take the exam, but you'll do it remotely. And in order to do so, you need to email me by 11:59 p.m. on Wednesday so I can email you the exam. And basically, I'll email it to you at 9:25. You'll take it when everyone else takes it. And submit it in at 10:40, or email it back to me at 10. So for the review for exam one, I'm going to kind of walk you through what the exam is going to look like and some pointers for it, and then we'll conclude by going through the concepts that you have. But basically, the exam will contain 5 to 10 of the concepts from the review guide. So I'm just going to pick 5 to 10 of the concepts. And then I'll ask you to define or explain the concept and provide a real-world example for the concept. So basically, you're going to have to explain or define what the particular concept is and then provide some type of real-world example of that concept. And so an example of a question would be define implicit bias and provide an example when it might be occurring in an organization. So this is kind of what a typical question will look like. And the best way for you to respond to these, especially as I'm grading multiple exams, is to make it explicitly clear what part of the prompt you're responding to. So just simply, if you start off, implicit bias is, then I know, okay, they're providing me the definition for implicit bias, and write the definition. And then for the next part, to say an example of when implicit bias might be occurring is, and just provide that answer. And the idea is sometimes students will kind of meander or provide a big prelude to what they're going to say, and they're going to say diversity is really important in society, and a lot of organizations discriminate, and that's not good for employee outcomes, and it hurts businesses, and that's why implicit bias is important. But they never really answer the thing that I asked them to. And really, as I'm grading these, I'm looking for ways to give you points. But if you just talk generically about diversity being important and discrimination being bad, I can't really give you points. But if you show me, okay, implicit bias is, then I can look at it and give you points. So you serve yourself by just simply getting straight to the point and responding to the prompt, and even queuing me up for, okay, hey, I'm responding to this part of the question. And then an important thing is if you give me a perfect definition of implicit bias, but don't give me an example, you're automatically gonna get only half the points for that question. Because if you don't answer both parts, then I can't give you points for a part that you didn't even answer. So make sure you read the question and answer each part. And inevitably, each semester or each exam, someone forgets to answer a particular part, and I'm like, ah, and I'm stuck because I just can't give you points for something you didn't respond to. And then be very, very specific and provide specific details. So in this one, it says, an example of when implicit bias might be occurring is in businesses that discriminate. That's gonna hurt you because it's not very specific, it's just kind of broad. But if you say implicit bias can occur, example would be when a white male employee is interviewing a black female employee, applicant, that employee might have implicit bias in sort of reading into stereotypes of what might be true of the black female applicant. And so you can, you provide a very specific context or setting. So I'm like, oh, okay, this person gets what implicit bias is. So if you just give a generic thing, it's hard for me to know, well, does this person really know? So if you give a specific example or give specific details, the better off you'll be. So then, avoid vague terms like diverse or experiences or perspectives or beneficial or helpful. So, you know, again, in this example, implicit, you know, if you said an example of when implicit bias might be occurring is it changes the employee's perspective on situations, or it hurts the organization from becoming diverse. You know, like, you just, you know, if you give sort of general answers, I don't know if you're, the assumption is, well, maybe they just simply don't know, and so they're just trying to fill it with words that are common words to this course, and it's hard for me then to know whether you really understand the concept. So those are some general concepts, general comments. Some other ones are, so because there's going to be like 5 or 10 different questions, and I'm going to ask you to provide examples, you can't reuse the same example. Like, you can't have that one example that you use for every question. So if you reuse an example, it's going to hurt you, because I want, you know, there's tons of examples out there. So choose a different example for each situation. You're allowed to reuse social dimensions. So if you're talking about race or religion or class, you can reuse those. But like the specific examples you give, don't reuse them. Okay, this is really important. Don't use the word diverse or representative without a descriptor. So, and even in the diversity audit projects, you would say, oh, this organization is very diverse. But every time you use the word diverse, you need to say, oh, is it religiously diverse? Is it gender diverse? Is it racially diverse? Because just saying the word diverse, either it implies, oh, well, I was talking about race, because that's usually what diversity is referring to, but then it sort of enshrines this idea that diversity is only about race. And so anytime you're going to use the word diverse, make sure you put a descriptor of what type of, what social dimension you're talking about. So, yeah, don't say the organization is not diverse. Say the organization is not gender diverse or gender representative. So, straightforward. Be careful not to play into stereotypes. So there's this tendency when you give examples to sort of reinforce stereotypes that exist. So, you know, if you're giving an example of, let's say, women in the workplace or women in doing human resource management, don't say women are more caring and men are the breadwinners, you know, sort of, and that's why these outcomes occur, because that's just sort of reinforcing stereotypes. A better way to say it is that some women are perceived as being more caring, or, you know, like, don't, I guess, sort of in a deterministic way say women are this way and men are this way. You can say this is how they're perceived, and so in interviews, if they're perceived this way, it could influence the outcomes of the interview. Versus saying this is what they are and this is what men are. Okay, this one's, let me break this down. So a population's demographics is not an explanation for why certain groups are underrepresented among the staff. I'm going to get into this. So like if an organization has is underrepresented amongst Asian Americans, let's say, don't say that Asian Americans are underrepresented among the staff because there's not enough Asian Americans in the population. So the idea of representation is you take the population and you say, okay, what percentage of the population is Asian American? And let's say it's 15%. Then in the organization, if you want the organization to be representative of Asian Americans, it should be 15% Asian Americans. And let's say it's only 2% Asian Americans. If you say the reason why Asian Americans are underrepresented in the organization is because there's not many Asian Americans in the population. Well, representativeness basically is only saying there should be an equal proportion of Asian Americans in the organization that are also in the population. It's not saying that there should be, you know, 50% Asian Americans. It's just simply saying what's the percentage in the population, then it should be reflected in the organization. Does that make sense? Like, there's a tendency to think, oh, well, the reason why IU has is not representative of African Americans is because there's not many African Americans in Indiana. Well, no, all representativeness basically says what's the percentage of African Americans in the state of Indiana, then they should be that percentage at IU if IU is going to be representative of African Americans. So I'm just pointing that out because that seems to trip people up sometimes. Representation is relative to the population. And again, I want to put all these slides up, so don't like feel like you need to write all of it down. So a big theme in this class is differences between individual level explanations and structural explanations, just like the basketball exercise. You know, if I want to explain the outcome of someone who made a basket, yes, to some extent, your individual capacity as a basketball player influenced whether or not you made the basket. But really, by far the predominant explanation for the outcome of whether or not you made the basket was structural, your structural position in the classroom, like where you were located. It had less to do with your individual level abilities. And so this comes out with the diversity audit projects and also with the exam. If the preschool teachers is highly overrepresented amongst women, like predominantly most preschool teachers are women, and we'd say, well, why aren't there more men as preschool teachers? You could say an individual level explanation is that, well, it's just because men don't want to be preschool teachers. Or a structural explanation would be that there's just a strong social bias against hiring men to be preschool teachers. Like societally, if, you know, when a male person goes to apply for a preschool position, because there's so much social bias against men teaching small kids, that's a structural reason why there's very few male preschool teachers. If you just say, well, men must not be interested in being preschool teachers, that's sort of an individual level explanation. And some of you did it in like the diversity audit projects, like, or if you talk about, why are there few female firefighters? Well, it must be because women aren't interested in being firefighters. Or is it because the fire departments tend to be gender biased and they tend to want to only hire male firefighters. So know in your mind sort of the difference between what's an individual level explanation for a particular outcome and what's a structural, more societal explanation. To explain why African Americans are underrepresented among the staff, don't just say, well, it must be because no African Americans applied. Like, if African Americans would have applied, then we'd have more African Americans among the staff. You'd want to look at, possible structural explanations. Well, maybe where are they recruiting applicants from? And if they're recruiting from places that are predominantly white or predominantly non-African American, that could also be a reason why there's fewer African Americans that are underrepresented amongst the staff. Let's see. To address African Americans' underrepresentation among the staff, don't just say, okay, so let's say African Americans are underrepresented amongst the staff. Don't just say, well, then hire more African Americans. Like, you have to look at, well, what's sort of the overarching structural reasons or explanations for why there aren't more African American staff. So propose a solution that addresses a structural cause. So maybe it's something like implicit bias in the interviewing process, or maybe it's that all the hiring managers are white employees, and so then they have bias in their hiring process. So it isn't looking at, well, must be that the individual applicant wasn't qualified. It's more looking at what are more systemic reasons for these particular outcomes. And the last one is a warning. So there's a lot of online resources related to this course. The problem is that they're uploaded by students and some of them are not accurate. And so don't rely on the online, let's see if I put it here, yeah. Use the textbook and the lectures for studying this exam. So basically what's happened is people take like this review sheet or earlier versions of this review sheet and upload it with answers, but it's the students who provided the answers, and sometimes the answers are not right. So it's just not reliable. So that's why I'd say use the textbook and lectures for studying for this exam versus just finding a version of this review sheet online and downloading it and thinking, okay, I'm just going to memorize this stuff, because a lot of it is accurate, but not all of it, and you don't know, you might not know how to differentiate. So those are general comments. Any sort of questions about either the structure of the exam or just some of these comments that I put up? Yeah. More or less, either a definition or explain or describe like this concept and then provide an example.
So is all of it written? Like, is there not like multiple choice?
Yeah, it's all written. Yep. Yeah.
So there's gonna be between 5 and 10?
Yes. Okay. Yep. Was that your question, Victoria? Okay. Okay, so now I'll transition to any questions about the terms on the sheet that you want me to address or re-explain or clarify or anything like that.
Yeah. Out?
What did you say?
Can I take my
computer?
Sure. Out?
Yeah. Yes.
Can you explain the one drop rule?
Okay, so the one drop rule is it's predominantly focused on African Americans. And it was during the Jim Crow laws where it would say, you know, were they separate but not equal? And so they had separate institutions for African Americans that were separate from the white population. But then the question was, well, some people are interracial, like they're half white and half black, like they had a white father but a black mother. And so that person was 50% black. And so the U.S. government had to decide, well, how do we determine whether or not someone is black? Because then what if someone had one grandparent who was African-American but three other grandparents who were white? That person was 25% black. And then if you sort of go out even further, there are some people who were 12% black. And basically Congress made a law or a statute that was known as the one-drop rule, is that if you had one drop of African American in your blood or in your heritage, then you would be considered black. And so it's basically like if you had even one drop of blackness in your blood, then by law, you would be treated as a black person. Does that make sense? Yes. Yeah, so DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And it's basically, that's the umbrella government policy of basically the U.S. has a variety of immigration policies, and one in particular is how do we handle children who are brought here, in a sense, out of their control. Like they were brought here by their parents. In general, children that come to the U.S. as immigrants, brought here illegally by their parents. The government policy for how to respond to that situation, they form this DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which basically says that we're not going to prosecute children for being brought here illegally by their parents. So we're going to defer the action. And so in many ways, it's providing a pathway to citizenship for these children so that they can sort of become legal citizens, or sort of be on a pathway to becoming a legal citizen. And a critical component of DACA is the DREAM Act, which basically is giving children who arrived in the U.S., as you know, under the age of 18, I believe, that they would have the opportunity to go to college and pay like in-state tuition, or that they would have an opportunity to get a job for 2 years and reapply to get a job. The potential drawback of this is that they have to declare themselves as being an illegal immigrant in the U.S. So they have to declare themselves to the U.S. government saying, yes, I came here, I'm undocumented, I came here illegally, I was brought here by my parents, but I want to take advantage of the opportunities of the DREAM Act and DACA program. And that was great under the Obama administration, because it was creating a pathway for citizenship. But then many aspects of DACA and many aspects of the DREAM Act have been brought to the courts as being unconstitutional or problematic, and even President Trump has issued executive orders that undermine the DACA program and put these immigrants in sort of a vulnerable situation of being declared undocumented and not getting the protections and privileges that come with the DACA program. So the DACA program isn't sort of set in stone, it's this shifting policy. And so as we showed, like with the DREAM Act, some states have adopted the DREAM Act, allowing, if you graduate from high school in the particular state and you're undocumented, some states allow you to pay in-state tuition, and other states haven't passed the DREAM Act, and so you'd have to pay out-of-state tuition. So in there's a lot of different examples of sort of DACA and the DREAM Act and its impact on childhood arrival. So the main focus is, what do we do with children who arrived here illegally, and how can we sort of accommodate their situation where they didn't choose by their own volition to break the law. They were brought here by their parents. Yeah.
What is the difference between minority groups and non-dominant groups?
Okay, so let's see how I put that. Yes. Okay, so we tend to think that the minority group is the group that lacks the power in a society. And generally, that's highly correlated. It tends to be, if you're part of the minority group, then you're the one who lacks the power. But it's not always the case. There's situations like in South Africa where the minority group was the white people. They were only 10% of the population in South Africa, and yet they were the dominant group. They had all the positions of power and authority in that society during the apartheid era. So, and even in some organizations, the male employees might be the minority. Like if you think of like the public school system or hospitals, they tend to have proportionally fewer men than women, but all the men are in positions of power and authority. So a elementary school, let's say, has overrepresentation of women amongst the teachers, but if you look at the principal and the administrative level, or the school board is disproportionately represented by men. So like the superintendent is probably 50% men, 50% women, and principals are 50% men, 50% women. And so even though men are the minority, they're still the dominant group in that setting. Yeah.
Yeah. Dominance kind of relates to power
positions? Yeah. Okay. And it's just mainly to point out that it isn't always the case that the minority group is the one that lacks power. Sometimes there are situations where the minority group is a minority, but they still retain all the power in that community or in that organization. Yeah.
Can you talk about identity-based organizations?
Yeah. So identity-based organizations is this idea, like even at IU, there's student organizations or departments that are identity-based, like the African-American Studies Department or the Latino Cultural Center. And they are organizations that are defined and shaped around a particular identity. And, or even like you could say, like we have Black History Month, and it's this focus on a particular identity. And what's noteworthy about that is that you wouldn't hear about a White History Month or like a white person's study department. And the reason is because like the history department is sort of implicitly the white history department, or like Black History Month exists because the other 11 months were taught white history. And so this idea of identity-based organizations or initiatives acknowledge that the predominant or the sort of the main mode in which organizations operate is from a white framework. And so it's then, or from like the dominant framework. And so these identity-based organizations create space for alternative identity, different identities to be represented. So even like, you know, you have a women's studies department. It exists because universities used to be disproportionately led and taught by men from a male perspective. And so the identity-based organization of like a women's studies department or feminist studies, it, you know, emerged because of the dominance of the male perspective in those settings. Same with like religious studies department. Like you don't have, like we have a Muslim, let's see, Islamic, I forget what the actual name is, but basically it's focusing on Islamic religion. You don't have like a Christian center focusing on Christian studies because the religious studies department used to be just predominantly looking at Christian Christian religion. Yes. Okay, so fundamental attribution error. The example that I had given is two people applying to Harvard. And if it's a white person applying to Harvard and getting in, so someone from the dominant group has a successful outcome, we attribute that outcome to their individual characteristics. And if a person from the non-dominant group, let's say a Latina student applies to Harvard and gets in, we attribute the success of them getting in to structural explanations. Well, it must be because of affirmative action, or it must be because of a quota system, or, you know, there's the focus is not on the student's individual attributes, but it's focused on structural explanations. So that's for successes. When failures occur, so like, again, when the Harvard grad, the white Harvard grad goes to apply for a job and doesn't get the job, that's a failure. We attribute that failure for the dominant group to structural causes. Like, well, it must be because, again, something like affirmative action or a policy within the organization to only hire people of color or some sort of thing. It doesn't, we don't attribute it to the individual. Like the failure isn't, it isn't because the person was just not smart enough or didn't have good enough grades. It must be some structural explanation. But when someone from the non-dominant group has a failure, like applies for a job and doesn't get accepted, we attribute the failure to the individual. Well, the person must be lazy, the person probably wasn't qualified, the person wasn't smart enough. So it's called fundamental attribution error, is because we attribute successes and failures differently depending on whether you're from the dominant group or from the non-dominant group. Yes, Destiny. Okay, so biodiversity was probably the first class session or lecture where the focus was on biodiversity is in how diversity exists in the natural world, like in the agricultural world, where you had the one company or McDonald's was saying, hey, we want you to produce, they go to these potato farmers, they say, we want you to produce potatoes for us, but the one criteria is that you can only plant and harvest this one specific species or type of potato. And so they said all the other species of potato that you have on your farm, you have to eliminate, and you can only focus on this one type of potato. And it created a monoculture of this one type of potato, and they didn't rotate crops or anything like that. They just kept producing the same crop, and it was considered a monoculture in terms of agriculture. And what it did was, what the outcome was, is that it caused a lot of disease and a lot of problems for the farming industry because of these monocultures. In the video that we watched, you know, the person was saying, you know, the natural world thrives with diversity, like a diversity of habitation within the ecosystem. And when you restrict that, when you try to make it a monoculture, make it, you know, when you take away the diversity in the natural world, it leads to a lot of problems. And so then the parallel is that in the social world, that if you constrain things and make the social world homogeneous, or like an organization homogeneous, it can lead to, in the same way, it can lead to problems. So a key distinction is that biodiversity is related to the natural world, like the ecological world, like agriculture and forest and habitations. They thrive, those systems thrive when they're diverse. And this class focuses on social diversity. And in the same way, the argument is made that homogeneous societies can be problematic and lead to negative outcomes, in the same way that the natural world can produce negative outcomes when there's not diversity. Yes, Ethan. Okay, so standpoint theory relates to, so everyone in your organization has a certain standpoint, and their standpoint is based on their social position. So the example I gave is like, your standpoint is your social position, and your social position is based on your social characteristics, like your gender, your race, your religion, your class. So each person has a different standpoint based on their social position. So my standpoint, let's say this is my social position, this is my standpoint, and it shapes my perspective of the organization in the way that I see it. And so if everyone in your organization has the same social position, they're all seeing the organization from the same standpoint, and they have a limited perspective of the organization. And so by having in your organization, having a diverse organization leads to people having multiple standpoints represented, which leads to better decision making within the organization, versus if everyone is from the same social position, like it's all white Christian males, they all occupy the same social position, and they're going to have the same standpoint or vantage point from which to view the organization, and it limits their ability to make good decisions or to understand the organization from a variety of perspectives. This is good. You guys are quizzing me, so that's... Yes.
Can you explain the myth of meritocracy?
So the myth of meritocracy is, the idea is that the U.S. was founded on this concept of it being a meritocratic society, that if you work hard and play by the rules, you will be successful. Like, you will be judged solely by your merit. And so the idea is that it creates opportunities for upward mobility, in that you can, no matter where you were, like what status you were born into the society, that if you work hard, you can succeed. Like, if you play by the rules, and people will be judged solely based on their merit, compared to other societies that are not meritocracies. Like, examples would be in certain parts of India where they have the caste system, and the caste system is adhered to strongly, to where if you were born into a certain caste, let's say the lowest caste, you will never have an opportunity to break out of that caste. And also, if you're born into the higher caste, there's almost very little that you can do to lose your status of that caste. And so it's a more rigid structure, whereas a meritocracy says, you know, you will be judged on your merit, not on sort of your social heritage, like your genealogy. But it's a myth to think that the U.S. only looks at a person's merit. And so what we see is that there's cumulative advantage that people have, where basically it's like, you know, I guess an example would be like college admissions. Colleges don't admit students solely based on their merit, on their GPA and on their SAT scores. They'll look at, well, you know, students of alum or applicants of alumni, especially wealthy alumni, are given an advantage over other applicants, and it doesn't have anything to do with their merit. It has to do with their relationship, you know, being having connections to someone who's a wealthy donor. And so same with like job applications, like a lot of it depends on your networks, who you know gets you an internship or gets you a job in a particular organization, even if you're a lower qualified person. So a meritocracy would say the most qualified person will get the job, will get admitted. And that would be a true meritocracy, but that doesn't always happen in the U.S. And so it's this idea of the U.S. being truly a meritocracy is a myth. It's not completely true in all situations, in all settings. Good question. Yeah.
Do the tests usually take people the full time?
Some people get done in half the time, some people take the full time. So no one's ever come and said, I need more time. That's probably the best indicator that it's typically, yeah, no one, in all the years, no one said, hey, I need more time. So any other questions? Yeah.
What's the new Jim Crow law?
Okay, the Jim Crow laws were established during the Reconstruction era, like after the Civil War, and you know, there's this short period called Reconstruction, but very quickly, particularly in the South, was the establishment of these Jim Crow laws, which basically the Jim Crow laws were legalized discrimination, where it was separate but equal institutions, but really the institutions were not equal. They were still separate, but they were not equal. And it was this idea of providing subpar resources to the African American community, particularly like healthcare, public education, neighborhood services, public utilities, were all sort of subpar. And it was functionally legalized discrimination against African Americans. And during the Civil Rights period and the Civil Rights Act, that was the Jim Crow laws were abolished, were ruled unconstitutional. But from that emerged this idea of the new Jim Crow laws. And it's primarily centered around this idea of mass incarceration, where the criminal justice system in the US is biased against African Americans. Like, they're disproportionately arrested and convicted for crimes, even though in a sense a white person and a black person are proportionally commit the same amount of crimes, like say marijuana use. African Americans are disproportionately arrested and convicted and given stricter prison sentences compared to white people. And so even though the criminal justice system is supposed to be implemented equally to all across all people, it systematically discriminates against African Americans and people of color. And so it's functionally, even though the Jim Crow laws were outlawed as being unconstitutional, the new Jim Crow era is focused on mass incarceration in the criminal justice system as another institution that discriminates against people of color, and specifically African Americans. So it's not a law, but it's more someone said, yeah, I know we said that the Jim Crow laws were unconstitutional, but we, you know, society has sort of figured out a new way to discriminate or treat people of color unequally compared to white people. Yeah.
Is that like how some people are like restricted from voting for different reasons, like they don't have like their ID with them, or if they like do the gerrymandering thing to like move places and stuff?
It's a way of stripping the rights and privileges of Americans, but it's disproportionately affecting the non-dominant group. So even like with voting, in most states, if you have a criminal record, you can't vote. Or in most states, if you go to apply for a job and you've been convicted of a crime, you have to check a box saying, I've committed a crime. That's the Ban the Box initiative to say, listen, if African Americans and people of color are disproportionately being arrested and convicted of crimes, even though white people commit these crimes at similar rates, then the system, like the long-term effects of not only going to prison, but then not being able to vote, having a more challenging time getting a job, like it disadvantages people of color, not just in that moment, but for the rest of their lives. Like the vote not being able to vote is a restriction for the rest of your life, and having to be able to declare that you were convicted of a crime is something you have to do for the rest of your life, even though you paid your punishment to society. And so then that those policies are problematic if the criminal justice system isn't being applied equally across all groups, and it's disproportionately targeting people of color, and so that's where it's problematic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Intersectionality.
Okay, so early on in the class, we talked about social dimensions. So you have like race, gender, religion, class, age, disabilities, and there's a tendency to analyze along each dimension. So you look at like race and look at the outcomes of a particular race compared to other races or ethnicities. Or you look at gender and look at differences in outcomes between men and women. And so intersectionality basically says, well, you also have to look at the intersection of multiple dimensions. So if you look at the intersection of race and gender, are there even sort of amplified disadvantages if you are non-dominant in two social dimensions? So in a sense, the idea is like there's disadvantages to being a black person in this country, and there's disadvantages to being a woman in this country. There's even amplified disadvantages if you're a black woman in the society. So the intersection of race and gender reveals like even greater disadvantages when you're a non-dominant person or have a non-dominant identity across multiple dimensions. You experience amplified disadvantages. And so it could be a person of color who's from a minority religion. So they're the intersection of religion and race reveals amplified disadvantages or amplified advantages. Yeah.
Can you talk about double duty?
So double duty is a challenge for people from the non-dominant group who work for an organization. And the example I gave was like there's a Latina woman who was working for our organization that was predominantly white, and both of us had the same local level responsibilities, but then she had the extra duty of being a representative of the Latina population within the organization. So whenever we had like panels, she would be called on to be sitting on the panel as sort of to reflect the diversity of the organization, whereas the organization, for every 10 white males that we had, we only had one Latina woman. And so I would only be asked to do these things once every 10 times. She was being asked every time, or like she was put up front or put on panels, put on committees, because they wanted these things to be diverse. And so she was being constantly asked to do extra duty that wasn't really part of her normal job description. And the end result was that her local level performance suffered because she had to do double duty with regards to all these other extracurricular activities or responsibilities because she was a minority within the organization. And so then the dominant group doesn't really have to do double duty. They perform better at their local level responsibilities, and it makes that if you're not aware of the added responsibilities put on minorities within an organization, you could be blind to the fact that, oh, well, maybe their lower performance is because of the extra duties that they have to do because they're minority within the organization. Good question. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the anti-immigrant paradigm?
Yeah, so the, let's see where I put it. Okay, so the anti-immigrant paradox, so the U.S. is a country of immigrants. Everyone except for African Americans and Native Americans immigrated to the U.S., like voluntarily chose to come to the U.S., except for African Americans and Native Americans. In particular, all the white people came from different European countries of origin, and they immigrated here. And so we're a country of immigrants, and yet after a few generations of being in the U.S., a certain percentage of the population has adopted a more anti-immigrant stance or posture, where there's this opposition to immigrants, even though they themselves were immigrants. So it's a paradox, because how can we be a country of immigrants and be so opposed or against allowing new immigrants come to the U.S.? So that's the paradox. Like, you could understand if a country had, you know, was like, let's say Germany, where all the people are Germans, they've, you know, multiple generations of Germans, like, you could see where possibly, okay, yeah, they probably wouldn't want outsiders. But if you have a country where everyone was at one point an outsider that immigrated here, why all of a sudden are they opposed to immigrants? Ethan. I'll go through the whole thing. So population is any defined group. So like, in a sense, this classroom could be a population, IU could be a population, Indiana could be a population, the US could be a population. So that's sort of whatever boundary you have for a certain group of people, and it contains all the people. And then any population, you can divide that population or you can analyze that population along different social dimensions. And so social dimensions are the things like race, gender, religion, age, disabilities, not disabilities, sexual identity, like all the different social dimensions that you would look at a particular population. The social groups are along any particular dimension. So let's say religion, a social group, the different social groups on that dimension would be Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, like all the different social groups along that dimension. And then social composition is, okay, well, what's the percentage breakdown along that dimension? So what percentage are Protestant? What percentage are Catholic? What percentage are Muslim? What percentage are Buddhist? So social composition is, you start with a population, and you pick a particular social dimension, like religion, you look at all the different social groups on that dimension, and the composition is what's the percentage of each of those groups. So a simple one would be, if we looked at the gender composition of this classroom, we would just say what percentage of the students in this class are female and what percentage are male, and whatever other social groups you would identify in that dimension would be represented in that composition, like the percentages. Yes.
The example you gave for double duty.
Uh-huh.
Could that also be, just so that I like understand the one, the fundamental attribution error? Because when like, if people in the organization see her outcomes, like,
yeah,
her progress,
yeah,
as attributing it to her like personality or like that she's a bad worker or something.
Yeah. Yeah, so
really
that's
a systematic, like, error.
Yeah, that's a great example. So like combining double duty and fundamental attribution error. So, you know, most organizations you get annual reviews or performance evaluations, and so let's say they looked at my colleague Olivia, the Latina woman in the organization, and she gets her annual review, and she underperformed, like she didn't meet the marks. Fundamental attribution error would say, yeah, well, she probably just is not very hard worker, it's just not within her skill set, and they attribute the low performance or the failure to individual characteristics, when in reality, if they pulled back and looked at sort of the structural aspects of our organization, they would see, well, actually, the real attribution, the real reason why she's lower performing at the local level is because she's being pulled into all these different committees and extra responsibilities that reduce her ability to do her local level job. And so, and if I'm a enlightened manager, I would say, you know what, I don't want to fall into the trap of the fundamental attribution error, and sort of, I know there's a tendency to attribute failures to the non-dominant group, attributed to their individual characteristics, but are there structural things going on that could explain the lower performance or the failure? So yeah, that's a good combination of the two. Yeah.
Can you explain
homophily?
Sorry.
No, that's fine. It's a term that no one's ever heard of before, and it's one that you don't use in your normal everyday discussion, but it's something that is present in every social setting and present in everyone's life. It's an unconscious tendency to associate with people who are socially similar to you. And so you can look at, like we did the example of like student organizations that you're a part of. You voluntarily chose what organizations you wanted to be a part of. And because homophily is at work, most of you gravitated towards organizations that had people that were socially similar to you. So maybe similar religion, similar race, similar gender. Even if you look at the people that you've dated, or as you get older and you look at the neighborhoods that you move into or the schools that your kids will go to, like, it isn't saying that you're intentionally staying away from people who are different from you. It's like this unconscious tendency to associate with people who are similar. And I think I use the example where I went to an African-American church in an effort to resist the homophily tendency. And yet after 3 years of being in the church, which was predominantly African-American, I looked at the people who I actually hung out with the most from that church, and it was the other white people. So even though I was actively trying to resist homophily, there's this unconscious tendency to associate with people who are similar, socially similar to you. Yeah?
Can the same go for like social media on that? Like, you're going to follow people who have the same kind of, like, you know,
Yeah.
Share the same interest as you, basically.
Yeah. And I would probably argue that that's not unconscious. That's more a function of the algorithms within social media to sort of populate your feed with things that resonate with your perspective. And so I would be a little bit hesitant to use social media as the example, because homophily is truly an unconscious thing. Like when I went to the African American church, and I hung out with white people, I wasn't consciously saying, well, I'm going to go to this black church, but I'm only going to hang out with white people. Like, that wasn't my perspective going in. But when I stepped back and looked, I was like, wow, this is fascinating. Like, it was sort of without even consciously thinking about it, I ended up becoming friends with, you know, I should have just randomly been friends with whoever was there and just sort of established friendships, but I tended to gravitate towards the other white people in that church versus just randomly selecting my friends. Just like the student organizations, in a sense, you could just randomly join a whole variety of organizations, but we tend to gravitate, not intentionally, but just so. So that's why I'd be a little bit hesitant with social media, because there's a lot of other intentional conscious factors that direct what comes through my feed. Yeah.
Can you give an example of a subordinating system?
So a subordinating system, let's see where I have it in here. Okay. So a subordinating system, an example would be probably like the criminal justice system in contemporary society, where it's a system that systematically disadvantages one group over another group. And so it's a system that sort of systematically subordinates or disadvantages one group. And so in a sense, the criminal justice system should be impartial. It should be, you know, there shouldn't be unequal treatment depending on race or gender or things like that. But because its implementation is impartial, just like the police officer has discretion of whether or not they want to give you a ticket or not, like it's not impartially implemented and enforced, like there's discretion. And so it becomes a subordinating system, because if police officers are disproportionately giving tickets or arresting one group compared to another group, then that group that's being disadvantaged is being adversely affected by the subordinating system.
Is that different?
Well, so then what the outcome of that is structural inequality, or like another subordinating system would be the unequal distribution of resources to public schools. And so in a sense, you could, there's a valid argument that all public schools should have equal resources distributed to them for public schools. But because they're not receiving equal resources, it's a subordinating system where one group, one school system, or one population of schools is getting better resources than another population. And what that produces is structural inequality. So where the people who went through this school system are at a structural disadvantage, or there's inequality in their outcomes because of the subordinating system. Same with healthcare. Like, in a sense, public healthcare or healthcare in the U.S. should be provided equally to all people. Now, you can always have private schools and private healthcare and stuff like that, but if healthcare is a value of the society and it's a public good, the resources should be distributed equally. If they're not being distributed equally, it's considered a subordinating system where one group is disadvantaged and one group is advantaged, and it leads to structural inequalities. Oh my goodness. It's almost 10:40. You guys ask good questions. Any others? Yeah.
Is the book the best resource to divine needs?
I'll say the book and lectures, because some of the concepts are not addressed in the book. But all the lectures, the audio versions of the lecture are uploaded, and I'm going to take this recording and upload it, so you'll have a real-time version of this one. Let's see. No sense in going into Native Americans today. If you have any other specific questions related to the exam, you can come up and ask me.
So Native Americans will be on the exam?
The concepts for Native Americans will be. There's nothing on here. Like, everything that I covered on the sheet, we've already covered in class. So, yep. So we're done, but if you have specific questions, you can come up and ask me.